Hello and welcome to 42 Talks, the podcast which takes a deep dive into the legal world led by the experienced members of 42BR Barristers. My name is Paul Fuller. I'm a member of 42BR Barristers with a predominantly business and property practice, and I'm also a member of 42BR's Animal Welfare Group. I'm joined by two other members today, Marcia Hyde, a practitioner predominantly practicing family law, and Edmund Waters, a barrister with a regulatory and civil practice who also prosecutes for the RSPCA. This is the first of two episodes in which Marcia, Ed and I will be discussing the concept of animal sentience, the legal recognition of animal sentience, and ultimately the implications of all of that. Suffice to say that shoehorning a millennia of religious and philosophical thought and debate, a few centuries of scientific research and several decades of jurisprudence into two short podcasts is an impossible task. So this will be very much a whistle-stop tour, but it is one that we do hope you will find interesting and informative. So Marcia, assuming most of our listeners are human, we're all sentient beings, so probably have an idea of what it is to be sentient. If people are asked, they might talk about consciousness, awareness, and perhaps even spirit or the soul. But for an easy opener, what do we really mean when we talk about sentience?
Well, not such an easy opener, Paul, because what we mean by sentient is still open for debate. It's difficult to define. What we mean as a basic is an ability to experience feelings and sensations. Do we think that is also consciousness? Do animals have consciousness? Mm. Some people would say they do. Some people would say they don't. There's not necessarily an agreement across the board as to what we mean when we say an animal is sentient. It's still open for debate. There's still a lot of research on it. One of the ways of looking at it, and what I'm going to do is a quick whistle-stop tour through religion and philosophy and just look at how humans have seen animals from those perspectives. And that will take us into the area of animals in science and how science defines animal sentience. So if we look at religion first, and the ancient religions valued animals, but saw man as the only living creature who could develop a relationship with the gods, and therefore sacrificed animals to appease the gods. We then moved to ancient Greece and Rome, where again animals were used in rituals, but were also used as symbols for the gods, and they were seen as mediators between man and the gods. And some gods took on animal forms. So they were beginning to be revered. In the more Eastern religions, say, for example, Hinduism sees the divine or God in all creatures, and therefore all animals are revered. Animals in Hinduism represent a different divine or demonic quality. So, for example, the cow, who we all know is the most revered in Hinduism, that is seen as the divine mother. A swan is symbolic of wisdom, grace, purity, which is why most Hindus are vegetarian. Mm. In Islam, all creatures are seen as conscious creations of Allah, and therefore are to be respected and treated with care and compassion. Cruelty and torture are condemned. Animals are still seen, however, as created for human benefit, but must be treated ethically, and humans must be seen to cause them as least suffering as possible. But also in Islam, which is quite interesting, is animals are seen to be conscious of God, and in their own way praise him, which I find a very interesting concept when we look at consciousness and belief, etc. In Judaism, humanity again has dominion over animals, but cruelty is strictly forbidden. Buddhism is the only religion that accepts that all animals are sentient beings. Also the concept of rebirth, so that any animal can be reborn as a human and any human can be reborn as an animal. And they're therefore interconnected. The taking of life is banned and applies to all sentient beings and also extends to the animal world. And we'll come on to see the difficulties which science has with trying to see where, for example, insects may be sentient, whereas they accepted under Buddhism as being sentient. And I think, Ed, you had a view about Catholicism and stewardship, didn't you?
Yes, I was just going to mention, well, two religions and contrast them very, very briefly. I mean, there's the ancient, and you've touched on the ancient Indian religions. I mean, Jainism, one of the oldest of all, has this concept of ahimsa, which is one of the main pillars of it, fundamental principle forming very much the cornerstone of the ethics and doctrine of that particular ancient religion. It means really non-violence or non-injury to any life form at all. And it seems that the Jains have this concept that really the life force, or rather the soul, is present in every single animal and even plants. And that this idea of ahimsa, non-violence, is different from the concept perhaps found in other philosophies and religions. It's the idea that if you harm living beings, you're harming your own self or your own soul, which is in contrast to, and of course they don't have the concept of an overall creator. What you're in a cycle of birth and rebirth and reincarnation, and the idea is that by your behavior and your ethics you can escape the cycle of birth and rebirth. In contrast, in Catholicism, of course, where they have, there's of course the concept of an overall creator. You have the seventh commandment in Catholicism is interpreted as being respect for the integrity of creation. And in the Catholic Catechism, it very much, there's quite a lot of mentions, and I'll be very brief about this, for mentions of animals. And it's very clear that the use of vegetable and animal resources can't be divorced from the respect for moral imperatives, and that man's dominion, which is a concept, man's dominion over the inanimate and other living creatures, is granted by the creator, but it's not absolute. It's not. It's very much limited by the concern for your neighbour, but also it requires a religious respect for the integrity of creation, which of course, in relation to animals, which are all God's creatures, they have very much, Catholics have very much have a duty of stewardship and providential care, and that their mere existence means that men and women owe them kindness, and also very much that in the lives of the saints, of course, St. Francis of Assisi being the patron saint of animals, and there's plenty of stories from his life about his contact with animals and his interaction with animals. For example, one example, I won't dwell on them, when he talked to the birds, the doves, the crows and other birds, and effectively preached to them, and that they were able to listen and take it in. So very different, but again, enormous respect for the animal kingdom in both those religions, but from a very different ethical perspective and religious perspective. So it's very interesting. And one last point is that it's a very ancient idea, the idea of animal sentience, really. And even in ancient Rome, for example, you've got Porphyry, the first perhaps treatise on vegetarianism, the abstinence from eating animals, again, on the basis that because all animals are rational beings, he said that you should not eat animals for that reason. And certainly directed that teaching towards philosophers, if not soldiers or athletes, and asked them to adopt a vegetarian diet for that reason. So it has an ancient history, this idea of animal sentience and also animal welfare.
Yeah, and then, I mean, that's reflected, some of that is reflected in philosophy and the development of philosophy and the idea still remains, I think, in philosophy, which is reflected in religion, which is man still has dominion over everything. So if we start off with Aristotle, again, exactly that, nature has made all animals for the sake of man. So again, it's animals to be used, but usually always without cruelty and with care. Chinese philosophy is very different in the sense that always a recognition that animals could suffer and should therefore be treated with care and compassion. So it's slightly more towards the idea of animals as being sentient than Aristotle was, which was really animals were there for humans to use. We then get to Descartes, when human philosophy develops, and Descartes, early 17th century, so 1596 to 1650, his emphasis on reason as a way of understanding the world or explaining the world. And he saw reason and sentience as identical. He felt that animals had no reasoning, no thought, no consciousness or souls, and could not therefore be sentient. How he did see them was something which I think when we look back on it now, we find very difficult. He saw animals as complex biological machines, and he experimented on them. He did a lot of vivisection and a lot of quite vicious, cruel experiments on animals. And he considered their, what we now know or accept, are expressions of pain, both the physical reactions and the screaming and the noise. He considered them simply to be automatic reflexes and not expressions of pain. So that was a very troubled era. By the time we get to the 18th century, we get to utilitarianism and Jeremy Bentham and his introduction into principles of morals and legislation. And he, very much looking at animals and humans and how to improve the human condition for one and all, as it were, he directed us in respect of animals and said, don't ask whether or not animals can reason. Don't ask if they can talk, but ask, can they suffer? And that was a real change, a very fundamental change in the philosophical approach to animals during that century. We then move on to behaviorism in the early 20th century, which originally was a psychological theory to understand human beings, but was also extended to animals. And that was in the works of Watson and Skinner. And that saw behavior, both in humans and animals, as a reflex to stimulus from outside in the environment. And that led to concepts such as reinforcement of behaviors, punishment for behaviors. When applied to animals, it led to a view that animals really had no innate capacity to experience pain, suffering, or pleasure. They were simply responding to stimulus. And I think this is still reflected in some of the experiments which now more modern philosophers and scientists do to try and establish sentience in different creatures. And it's central to an idea of valence, which I know Ed and Paul, you're going to talk about in a moment. And then lastly, bringing us up to date in the way humans think of being in the world is a phenomenological approach, which looks at consciousness. By the time of the 20th century, early 20th century, people like Husserl, Heidegger, and Sartre, they are looking at things very differently and emphasize the structures of subjective conscious individual experience. So Heidegger talks about an individual being in the world and then the search for meaning within that context rather than for the scientific behaviorist causation explanation. And it becomes very much a focus on understanding consciousness and subjective experience. And that starts to bleed us into the work of the more modern philosophers looking at sentience, animal sentience, Birch, Broom, and in fact, I think Browning and Viet, they recently, 2021, are coming to understand that trying to use a phenomenological approach might give us a different way of trying to understand animals' experiences, although we can't know what it is to be a bat or a bird. We can use different philosophical ways in which we try to find meaning in consciousness and being, which will help us better understand how to find out which animal is sentient and actually what do we mean by it. So that leads lastly into the animal liberation approach, philosophical approach, and to someone like Peter Singer, who argues that equality is a basic moral principle, because there's always an overlap between sentience, morality, ethics, religion, philosophy. And what Singer would say is that equality should be applied to all animals because they have capacity to suffer. So that's a very, very, very whistle-stop tour of some of the ways that we can look at animal sentience in philosophy. But the main work is done on trying to uncover and unearth sentience in animals, and that's really through the scientific approach. So that takes us to Ed, because Ed, you, I think, are going to talk about the Cambridge Declaration of Consciousness.
Yes, I'll touch on that. One thing, just whilst you're there with Peter Singer, he does say in his seminal work, which of course in 1975, the great work Animal Liberation, he does refer to animal sentience, and he refers to the fact that philosophers have attempted to use sentience as a way of drawing the line of moral worth, and you touched on morality there. It's morality. The moral worth of an animal, I suppose, has been the central thing, central concept to the idea of if you're providing them with some welfare, rights or protection, then you have to determine which animals are covered. And he interestingly drew the line of sentience, if you like, somewhere between a shrimp and an oyster. But in the, you've asked me to say something about the Cambridge Declaration of Consciousness. This was July 7th, 2012, where there was a group of prominent scientists from all around the world. They came together to sign this declaration in which they affirmed really the evidence, that evidence indicates that many types of non-human animals have the capacity for consciousness. And in the declaration, they state this as follows. They state in this declaration, conversion evidence indicates that non-human animals have the neuroanatomical, neurochemical, and neurophysiological substrates of conscious states, along with the capacity to exhibit intentional behaviors. Consequently, the weight of evidence indicates that humans are not unique in possessing the neurological substrates to generate consciousness. Non-human animals, including mammals and birds, and many other creatures, including octopuses, also possess these neurological substrates. And what they mean by neurological substrates refers really to the foundational structures in a nervous system that makes it possible to generate consciousness. But there's no single substrate or structure that is necessary for consciousness across all types of animals. And the structures that can give rise to consciousness are different in different animals. So this leaves a level of uncertainty still today. And the human-like brain structure is not required for consciousness. And there are other structures. And there's a lot of detailed research that's gone on since then and before 2012 in this area. And we can move on then to Jonathan Birch, Professor Jonathan Birch, who's very important in this And I don't know, Paul, if you're going to say something about broom first, or the definition of broom.
Yeah, thank you, Ed. Well, of course, the Cambridge definition of consciousness might be said marks a real seismic shift in the academic approach to animal sentience. But as you alluded to there, it still really leaves open the question, how do we define animal sentience from the scientific perspective? And I know that probably you're going to come on to talk about the precautionary principle, which is highly relevant in that regard. But perhaps a not unreasonable starting point might be reference to the Encyclopedia of Animal Behaviour. And that sets out in its third edition various definitions. And as lawyers, of course, we like definitions. And an obvious starting place is the definition of sentience. And the Encyclopedia says this about sentience: it's having the capacity, the awareness and cognitive ability necessary to have feelings. So just like a good lawyer would do, the next question we should ask ourselves is, well, what do we mean by those other terms, awareness and feelings? Well, the Encyclopedia tells us that feelings is a brain construct involving at least perceptual awareness, which is associated with life-regulating systems and is recognisable by the individual when it reoccurs and may change behaviour or act as a reinforcer for learning. And lastly, awareness, the Encyclopedia says, is a state during which the concepts of environment and self, and crucially of self in relation to environment, result from complex brain analysis of sensory stimuli or constructs based on memory. And those definitions are cited in a 2012 paper by Professor Donald Broom, who was appointed as the world's first professor of animal welfare in 1986. He's a world leader. He's currently based at the University of Cambridge Veterinary School. And as you might imagine, has written extensively on the subject of animal sentience. And Broom posits that a sentient being is one that has some ability to evaluate the actions of others in relation to itself and third parties. So there we have the idea of the animal having an idea of itself separate to everything that is not itself, to remember some of its own actions and their consequences. So there we've got the capacity for memory, to assess risks and benefits, to have some feelings, and to have some degree of awareness. So lots of elements there. Ed, has the academic world tended towards favouring any of those elements over others when trying to really pin down what we mean when we talk about animal sentience?
Yes, moving on then to perhaps Professor Birch, Professor Jonathan Birch. He's the Professor of Philosophy at the London School of Economics. And he very much has been an important figure in the realm of animal sentience, and indeed in relation to the Animal Welfare Sentience Act 2022, which we will come on to in our second part of this podcast. And Professor Birch has a definition of sentience, which he uses and has used in relation to the Sentience Act, which I'll call it, but also he's written a book quite recently, 2024, called The Age of Sentience. But sentience takes in a broad sense, meaning the capacity to feel. In a narrow sense, it refers to the capacity to have feelings with a positive or negative quality, and that's valence, the idea of valenced experience. And a sentient being, in the sense relevant to what he has devised, a framework of principles, using the definition of a sentient being as being a system with the capacity to have valenced experiences, such as experiences of pain and pleasure. So it's not as simple as saying a sentient being is sentient because it can feel pain or because it can feel pleasure. It's something more complex than that. And we'll go on in a moment to the definition, or rather the tests that he proposes to determine whether or not a particular animal of a particular species can be regarded or could be regarded as sentient. And what he does is that he calls a particular system or particular animal, we're dealing with animals, a sentience candidate if there is an evidence base, and it's very much evidence based, that implies a realistic possibility of sentience in that particular animal. And that it would be irresponsible to ignore that when making policy decisions that will affect that particular species of animal or particular animal. The evidence base then is strong enough or rich enough to allow the identification of welfare risks and design and assess some precautions that you would take to protect the welfare of that particular animal. So those are sentience candidates. Of course, all vertebrates, really, and it's perhaps common sense. And one thing I would say, from a personal point of view, is that to me, it's obvious that in a lot of cases that animals are sentient. I don't need to be a philosopher or a scientist or a theologian to know personally that a dog or a cat is sentient. Everyone would probably agree with me there. But I would go further than that to say that cephalopods, octopuses, again, you would say, and, you know, I've watched the program Octopus My Teacher, and a lot of people have, and they've come out, having watched that program, will say, if they had any doubts, which I didn't have anyway, that an octopus is plainly a sentient being, that plainly they are. And not just that, of course, they're highly intelligent beings, but that's not the test. And I think it's accepted across the board that intelligence is not the same as sentience. Mm. And that's a very important point. But octopuses are plainly, in my view and most people's view now, I think, that are both sentient and intelligent. But that also applies perhaps to other creatures. And again, it's often a matter of personal awareness or rather assumption that other animals are plainly sentient, smaller animals than that. And of course, that's the debate that's important from the point of view of law, of course, and what policies, what laws should be made to protect species of animals, and what species, which species do you protect? And this, in his writings, and in particular The Edge of Sentience and other pieces of writing, Professor Birch and other philosophers and scientists have tried to come to a test, if you like, for determining whether or not an animal is sentient, in the sense that you then must take precautions and identify welfare risks, and the government and the group should take steps to protect the welfare of such animals. So there's sentience candidates where there's good evidence, really, of sentience. But there's also, he identifies investigation priorities. That's where an animal, a particular animal, might fall short of the requirements for sentience candidature, and it requires further investigation. And that might cover insects, fish, perhaps some smaller crustaceans, smaller shrimps, brine shrimps, for example. I don't know if you remember, they're called sea monkeys, but, you know, are they sentient when you get those as pets? And you put them in water, there's a kind of cyst. I don't think they're eggs, they're cysts or something, and they come alive. But are they sentient? And the same is true, of course, of gastropods. Are slugs and snails, are they truly sentient beings? Now, again, in my personal opinion, they do appear, just as a layperson, not as a lawyer or a theologian, they do appear to be sentient beings. They're certainly highly sensitive, and they certainly appear to be sentient in the sense they react and appear like they might feel pain. There's a debate, of course, about that. But they're not like us, of course. They don't have brains. They have ganglia, which are collections of nerve endings or nociceptors.
What I was going to ask you, Ed, was in the Birch framework, and the precautionary framework.
Yes.
Because as lawyers, we think about standard of proof.
Yes.
And his standard of proof is bar and act. I mean, can we, as lawyers, can we see them as balance of probabilities, beyond reasonable doubt? Can we use those kind of terms?
Well, I think he talks about precautionary, erring on the side of caution. in his works, and in particular in this book, The Edge of Sentience, which is a very good book. And I think this framework, and I haven't really mentioned the framework, I think I should say what the principles are in this framework. There are three essential principles. And what the first principle is, the duty to avoid causing gratuitous suffering. Now, that's, again, perhaps quite an obvious principle. And of course, we've touched on that in all the world religions, really, have that principle or ethical starting point. That you do have a duty to avoid gratuitous suffering at a minimum, really, to sentient beings, either intentionally or through recklessness or negligence. But of course, you've got to determine what are sentient beings first before you get to that point. Of course, not all suffering is gratuitous, and it might happen in the course of defensible activity, despite some proportionate attempts to prevent it. And again, the issue of or the principle of proportionality is very important within this framework. And the framework principle two that he has formulated is that sentience candidature can warrant precaution. So if a particular animal is a sentient candidate, then it would be reckless or negligent to make decisions, that be policy decisions or any decisions, to create risks of suffering for that animal without considering, very importantly, the question of what precautions are proportionate to those risks. So if, for example, you determined that a particular animal, a gastropod, for example, a snail or a slug, was a sentience candidate, what the question a government should ask is what as precautions would be proportionate to risk to those particular animals. And then the framework principle three is that assessments of proportionality, and this may go to your point, Marcy, how do you do that? Once you've determined that there's a sentience candidate and there's no certainty, there's an element of uncertainty even with sentience candidates. Mm. And there's also disagreement between different groups, scientists, philosophers, even about sentience candidates. But there's certainly disagreement in animals which may be described as investigation priorities. That's gastropods, for example, slugs and snails, garden snail. But the framework principle three he's formulated is that assessments of proportionality should be informed, democratic and inclusive, that's the phrase, and that he recommends that the democratic process should be used to assess what proportionate measures should be taken in a particular case. And he talks about the citizens' panels or assemblies to assess the proportionality of possible responses, and he posits that as a possibility. And he uses something called the Park test: permissibility in principle, adequacy, reasonable necessity, and consistency. But there's a lot of detail in that book and in his thinking, which I can't cover in this short podcast. But obviously, this is all very interesting. And perhaps I'll hand over to Paul to talk about the IME definitions.
Thank you, Ed. Yes, whilst Birch's framework model, his incorporation of the precautionary principle, and as Marcia has touched upon, his bar and act test, which is really an expansion, as I understand it, of the precautionary principle, where so long as there is sufficient evidence, it doesn't have to be perfect evidence of sentience, then the threshold is met, whether that's on the balance of probabilities or something else, I don't know. But if the threshold is met, then we must act, and that's a moral responsibility that we have. It's still very much a philosophical approach, and it still leaves open this question: how does one go about assessing whether that threshold is met? Mm. By reference to scientific criteria. And I suppose early contributors to the science-focused approach to establish sentience in animals was in a 1991 working paper of the Institute of Medical Ethics. And that posited seven criteria, which focused very much on pain experience, and that's something that Ed has touched upon, the valence aspect. And those seven criteria are a possession of receptors sensitive to noxious stimuli. Second, possession of brain centers of a higher level, which are analogous in some way to the human cerebral cortex. Number three, a possession of nervous pathways connecting the nociceptive system to the higher brain centers. Fourthly, the existence of receptors for opioid substances, especially within the brain. Fifth, evidence that analgesics modify the animal's response to stimuli that would be painful to a human. Sixth, functional similarity to the human response to stimuli that would be painful. And lastly, persistence of an animal's behavioural response to a painful procedure. And I suppose that's incorporating the learning and the memory aspects that we touched on earlier. Criticisms of the IME7 criteria include the fact that they are designed solely to assess vertebrates and not other invertebrate species that we've heard about, but also, and significantly, that they focus very much on pain response and behavioural criteria. And it's been argued that, for example, just because an animal might recoil from a painful experience in much the same way that we will if we were to touch a hot stove, it doesn't necessarily mean that that animal is experiencing pain or that that animal is experiencing the feeling of fear and anxiety that comes with the experience of pain. When we recoil from touching a hot stove, for example, and we can all think about this, the pain comes later. The experience comes later. The actual act of recoil is very much an automative response and arguably not evidence of sentience, but rather just an automatic response. And Ed, I know you were going to talk about the efforts that have been gone to try to finesse and refine key indicators of animal sentience within the scientific community, following on from the IME7 criteria.
Yes, absolutely. You've touched on one of the main problems with the IME criteria, which is this idea that a reflex in an animal is not necessarily convincing evidence of pain. And there's another problem that's been identified by Professor Birch and his team. But Professor Birch says, well, there's an assumption in criterion four about the type of neurotransmitters that modulate aversive experiences, and that assumption may not be valid for invertebrates, and there are other types of neurotransmitter that may potentially modulate aversive experience. And
that's receptors for opioid substances.
Yes, that's correct. So it's the idea that it concentrates these criteria, the IME criteria, perhaps too narrow. Criterion four is the reference to opioids, which is perhaps too narrow. Mm. So what he and his team did at the London School of Economics and Political Science, the LSE, they developed a new set of criteria, which they've called the LSE criteria, or he's called the LSE criteria. And the criteria 1 to 3 of these new criteria, they replaced the emphasis on higher and lower brain regions with an emphasis on the integrative brain regions receiving input from multiple sensory sources. But briefly, I think perhaps maybe the last thing we can do on this part of the podcast, the criteria which still focus on the idea of pain, there's 8 criteria there. Nociception is number one. That's the animal possesses receptors sensitive to noxious stimuli. Nociceptors, if I pronounce that correctly. Number two, sensory integration. The animal possesses integrative brain regions capable of integrating information from different sensory sources. Number three, integrated nociception. The animal possesses neural pathways connecting the nociceptors to the integrative brain regions. Four, analgesia. The animal's behavioural responses to noxious stimulus is modulated by chemical compounds affecting the nervous system in either or both of the following ways. A, the animal possesses endogenous neurotransmitter system that modulates in a way consistent with the experience of pain, distress, or harm, its responses to threatened or actual noxious stimuli. So this idea of noxious stimuli and really a reaction to that is very central to the to these criteria as well. B, the other way in which the animal's behavioural response to noxious stimulus is modulated by chemical compounds could be putative local anesthetics, analgesics such as opioids or anxiolytics and, or antidepressants modify an animal's response to threatened or actual noxious stimuli in a way consistent with the hypothesis that these compounds attenuate the experience of pain, distress, or harm. So these criteria are very much focused on the idea of the evidence of pain, distress, or harm. And five, motivational trade-offs. The animal shows motivational trade-offs in which, for example, the disvalue of a noxious or threatening stimulus is weighed or traded off against the value of an opportunity for reward, leading to flexible decision-making. Six, flexible self-protection. The animal shows flexible self-protection behavior. For example, wound tending, guarding, grooming, rubbing of a type likely to involve representing the bodily location of noxious stimulus. Seven, associative learning. The animal shows forms of associative learning in which noxious stimuli become associated with neutral stimuli or in which novel ways of avoiding noxious stimuli are learned through reinforcement. These forms of associative learning go beyond classical conditioning, which a single conditioned stimulus overlaps temporally with an unconditioned stimulus. And then eight, analgesia preference. The animal shows that it values a putative analgesic or anesthetic when injured in one or more of the following ways. A, the animal learns to self-administer putative analgesics or anesthetics when injured. B, the animal learns to prefer when injured a location which analgesics or anesthetics can be accessed. C, the animal prioritizes obtaining these compounds over other needs, such as food, when injured. So those are the criteria, which again, they concentrate very much on the idea of pain, distress or harm, or evidence of that. Those are indicators, really.
Thank you, Ed. So that paper I think that you've been referring to is Jonathan Birch's 2021 paper, Review of the Evidence of Science in Cephalopod Mollusks and Decapod Crustaceans. And that paper was instrumental in amendments to the Animal Welfare Sentience Bill, which has now become the Animal Welfare Sentience Act 2022, to include decapod crustaceans and cephalopod mollusks within the scope of the Act. And that really leads us nicely into the topic for the second instalment in this two podcast series, where we're going to be looking at animal sentience, its recognition in the law, and the implications of that. I suspect we've run woefully over time and we're going to be in trouble with our PR lady here, but quite right too, because as we said, this is a broad subject and we've really only scratched the surface, but we hope you've enjoyed this. Thank you for tuning in to 42 Talks. To listen to other episodes and of course this episode and the next episode, then you can find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you else you get your podcasts from. Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.